Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, as Texas Republicans push through a controversial redistricting plan that could net them five new congressional seats, Democrats are fleeing the state to block the vote. Now eyes turn to New York, where Democratic leaders, including Governor Kathy Hochul, are weighing their own redistricting options. We'll take you live to Albany, and we'll hear from a legal expert. Audrey Garrow of A Single Bite is here. They're the Sullivan County-based group providing nearly 1,000 farm-fresh meals a week, free to families in need. We'll learn about the increased need for food in the county, plus how their upcoming fundraiser at the Chandelier Music Festival is helping fuel this vital work. Plus, the Vannevar Caravan's Night at the Movies brings big screen to life on stage in a one-night-only variety show, and local economic perspective. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. More than 50 Texas state lawmakers have abruptly left their state. They're trying to block a vote by the Republican-led Texas House on a GOP congressional redistricting plan. It's backed by President Trump. The Republicans hope to change the districts to gain up to five more GOPs in the U.S. House. Democratic State Representative Gina Hinojosa says the Republicans are taking a step that she finds is race-based.
In Austin, where I represent, we have two seats in Congress. This bill would eliminate the Latino opportunity seat. Similar thing happens in Houston, which is the city with the largest Latino population in all of Texas. Their Latino opportunity seat will be removed.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott is telling the Democratic lawmakers to return immediately. He says if they don't, he'll seek to have them kicked out of the legislature. The governor says if the Democrats are removed, he will seek to replace them with state legislators of his own choosing. Former special counsel Jack Smith is under federal investigation. The probe comes just days after a Republican senator formally requested a Hatch Act investigation into Smith. NPR's Luke Garrett reports.
The U.S. Office of Special Counsel confirms to NPR that it is investigating Jack Smith, who previously led a federal investigation into then-candidate Donald Trump and brought two criminal indictments against him. Smith resigned weeks before Trump's second inauguration. Federal officials are investigating Smith for breaking the Hatch Act, which prohibits certain political activities by government officials. Last week, Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton requested this investigation for what he called unprecedented interference in the 2024 election. No specific evidence of wrongdoing has been shared publicly, and Smith could not be immediately reached for comment. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel has no prosecuting power and can only discipline current federal employees. Luke Garrett, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened higher this morning as OPEC and its allies announced plans to boost oil production. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials jumped more than 400 points in early trading.
Saudi Arabia and other big oil-producing countries, including Russia and Iraq, plan to increase oil output by more than 500,000 barrels a day next month. The news sent crude oil prices lower, while retail gasoline prices showed little change. A new poll by the Associated Press finds most Americans are concerned about the rising cost of groceries. One of the nation's biggest meat producers, Tyson Foods, has been raising prices for both beef and chicken. Tyson reported better-than-expected quarterly sales today and raised its forecast for the full year. 3,200 Boeing machinists are on strike after rejecting a contract offer that promised 40% pay raises over the next 4 years. The walkout affects three Boeing factories that make fighter jets. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. The International Committee of the Red Cross is demanding that all hostages held by Hamas in Gaza be immediately released. Videos of two emaciated Israeli hostages were released over the weekend. Their dire condition drew harsh condemnation from world leaders. There's been tremendous anger in Israel. Many Israelis are calling for the Israeli government to reach a deal to free all hostages. In the U.S., record crowds turned out for this year's Lollapalooza Music Festival in Chicago. Summer Van Benton with member station WBEZ spoke to some of those attending the multi-day event.
The annual four-day music festival brought thousands to Chicago's Grant Park. Janae Howard says she got the chance to catch familiar acts while discovering new ones.
I think I would tell my friends and family that I got a whole bunch of concerts for the price of one, and I think that that's a really big flex.
She brought her friend Zach Dodd, a first-time festival goer.
It's a great opportunity to see love and peace and kindness and to see what the best city in the world has to offer in community.
Sabrina Carpenter, Tyler the Creator, and A$AP Rocky were among this year's headliners. For NPR News, I'm Summer Van Benton in Chicago.
Forecasters say smoke from Canadian wildfires is still moving into the U.S. The National Weather Service has posted several air quality alerts from the upper Midwest to the Northeast. There are alerts from Wisconsin to Maine. Senior citizens, children, and those with health conditions affected by smoke are being asked to remain indoors. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As you heard from NPR News, there was an air quality alert in several regions, including our region, due to smoke from Canadian wildfires, reducing visibility at times. Folks with pre-existing conditions are advised to stay indoors. That air quality alert lasts until midnight tonight. And you also heard about Texas, in the GOP in Texas, lawmakers advancing a controversial congressional map through a House committee, potentially securing five additional Republican-leaning seats in the House as political tensions escalate ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. In response, over 50 Texas Democratic legislators fled the state, traveling to cities like Chicago, Boston, and New York in an attempt to deny the House the two-thirds quorum needed to pass their map. Governor Greg Abbott has since issued an ultimatum: return by Monday afternoon or receive a legal action, face legal action, removal from office, and daily fines of $500. Against this volatile backdrop, Democratic leaders in New York are watching closely. Governor Kathy Hochul has warned she'll take a, quote, close look at mid-decade redistricting should GOP map drawing efforts gain traction in Republican states. Currently, New York's Independent Redistricting Commission limits redrawing to once per decade, but state lawmakers are now exploring legislative changes to introduce mid-cycle districts if Republicans proceed elsewhere. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Lucas Willard spoke with Columbia Law School professor Richard Briffelt to unpack the legal, political, and ethical stakes of the mounting redistricting battle.
As Republicans fear losing their narrow House majority in the upcoming midterms, GOP leaders in some states are discussing redrawing congressional district boundaries to give their party an advantage in 2026. In Texas, Republicans could gain as many as five House seats if redistricting efforts are successful. In response, New York Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul recently suggested she would take a close look at the possibility of redistricting in the Empire State. But unlike Texas, New York has in place a constitutional amendment that tasks an independent authority to redraw district lines in accordance with the U.S. Census, which occurs every 10 years. Now, some New York Democrats are supportive of legislation that would amend the state constitution to allow for mid-decade redistricting if other states follow through. To learn more about the latest redistricting battle, I spoke with Richard Briffelt, a professor at Columbia Law School.
It's pure President Trump pushing for partisan gerrymandering. It's entirely about trying to increase the number of Republican seats by taking districts which are currently constitutionally valid and have been in use and saying if we can find some states where we can rearrange them, we can increase the number of Republican seats. We can add more Republicans to seats where the Democrats are, or maybe remove Democrats from areas where the Democrats have won and turn those districts into Republican districts, just so that the Republicans can maintain control of the House of Representatives in next year's elections. It's entirely about that. There's no good government, voting rights, constitutional basis for this. It's entirely a partisan gerrymandering power grab.
So there's a real fear among Republicans that they could lose the House in the midterms.
Right. I mean, traditionally, the party in power loses seats in the midterm elections. Not always, but that the general cycle, and they have a very narrow majority. So I think they want to pad their majority by adding seats. Places like Texas, where they hope they can add as many as five to offset the possible loss of seats elsewhere.
Now, typically, redistricting is done every 10 years. It coincides with the U.S. Census. But is there anything in the Constitution that prevents states from redistricting early, so to speak, 5 years in from right. the usual 10-year
Or late.
Yeah.
it's not really that early so much as just doing it over again. The U.S. Constitution says nothing about this, so there's no U.S. constitutional prohibition.
Now, New York Governor Kathy Hochul recently took a look around and saw what was happening in states like Texas and said, well, maybe this is something that we can look into as well. But New York had a bit of a long, drawn-out saga with its last bout of redistricting, and that turned into a political mess. You know, do you have chances that New York will actually open the door to this?
Almost certainly not. I mean, you asked before whether the Constitution prohibits this mid-decade redistricting. The federal Constitution doesn't, but the New York State Constitution does, as a result of a redistricting reform amendment that was adopted about 10 years ago and then got its first workout at the beginning of this decade. Now, it's one of the few things that the New York State Constitution basically says, once the redistricting is completed, it's good until the next census. So in order for New York to do a mid-decade redistricting, New York would have to amend the state constitution, and that is impossible to do before the 2026 election. So I don't know what people are talking about. I mean, it could be you could amend it to make it possible for future years, and even then you'd have to get the voters to approve the amendment. But the odds of it happening in New York are less than 1%. You never say never, I guess, but the odds of it happening in New York are kind of under 1%.
Now, maybe, Richard, if you could sort of take me back a little bit about the saga that New York experienced. In 2022, an independent redistricting commission proposed maps, two sets of congressional maps, because the commission itself couldn't agree on one.
Right,
and that was ultimately rejected by lawmakers, state lawmakers. And then that kicked off a whole back and forth that stretched on in the courts for a couple of years after that. Could you give me sort of a brief history lesson here?
Well, that's what you said is basically what happened. The New York voters amended the Constitution sometime in the 2010 decade. I forget exactly what year, and it kicked in for the post 2020 redistricting. They created an independent redistricting commission, which couldn't force the recommendation on the legislature, but the legislature had to deal with it. This time, and also the Constitution also put in various procedural and substantive provisions about what could and could not be done in redistricting. As you mentioned, the IRC, the Independent Redistricting Commission, deadlocked, so the legislature was kind of a bit freer to do what it wanted to do, and it adopted a plan which kind of leaned Democratic, and that was challenged on both procedural grounds in terms of their failure to even give any weight to what the IRC had done, and on substantive grounds. They violated various provisions in the Constitution. Your courts were kind of divided, but in the end, they agreed with the challengers in part and struck down the maps. Things went back to the redistricting process, and this time the IRC actually came up with a recommendation. There was a bipartisan support, which the legislature basically adopted. So it was a rough ride, but in the end, the system more or less worked, and we have a plan that did have bipartisan support.
Now, we started this conversation by talking about and mentioning the U.S. Census, and the reality for New York State is that the population growth here is outpaced by a lot of other states, particularly in the South and in the Sun Belt. New York is losing population compared with those other states. Now, that means it could have an impact on the next round of redistricting after the next census. So, even if New York were to somehow change the Constitution and go through another redistricting process before the next U.S. Census, there's a reality there that the state is losing its people and therefore its representation, its number of representatives in Washington.
Right. I mean, after New York State will almost certainly lose at least one more seat after the 2030 census, which will show up in the 2032 election. It's not going to show up before then. And so that will certainly affect the composition of the state congressional delegation. It'll affect the way the redistricting of the state legislature. Of course, the size of the legislature won't change, but not only are we looking at with it within the state, we're looking not just the overall population, but the distribution of population within the state. When my sense is, I don't know this for sure, is that in New York State, most of the population loss is upstate. So that will show up the next time the legislature is redistricted, which again would be post-2030.
When it comes to states that are going through the redistricting process, like Texas, do you think that this could leave a bad taste in some voters' mouths if one side is picking up potentially five seats in the midterms because of redistricting, that this could have a backlash that could hurt Republicans in Texas?
Well, I got to say, I kind of hope so, that voters would be upset by this manipulation. But you never know with the vote, with voters. It may not be top of mind when voters actually go and vote. We don't know now what people are going to be focusing on 15 months from now. But you're going to hope that people are at least annoyed by this kind of blatant manipulation.
And thanks to Lucas Willard of the New York Public News Network for that report. As we went on air with this report, Governor Kathy Hochul has started a news conference in Albany with some of the Texas Democrats who fled the state to block the redistricting vote in their state. Let's go there live to Albany now.
Breaking the rules so they can hold on to power. And with that power, they're going to inflict even more pain. And they'd rather eliminate fairness in the system than to proceed knowing they're going to lose. They'd rather silence voters than serve them. From my perspective, to refuse to stand up and fight for our democracy as we are joining in solidarity with our friends from Texas means one thing. You won't fight for democracy, you're doomed to lose it. For almost 250 years, our democratic experience has been fought for, and it's endured. As governor of a state where many of those early battles took place, we're commemorating them next year. Those battles for freedom were here. That's why I cannot stand by and let this happen while Donald Trump and his co-conspirator, Greg Abbott, erode our democracy and drag us toward authoritarianism. Now, what Texas and Republican states are doing at the direction of Donald Trump, I say is nothing short of a legal insurrection against our capital. Legal meaning they're using the legal process does not mean it's legal, and it must be stopped. If Republicans are willing to rewrite these rules to give themselves an advantage, then they're leaving us no choice. We must do the same. There's a phrase, you have to fight fire with fire. That is a true statement of how we're feeling right now. And as I've said, another overused but applicable phrase, all's fair in love and war. That's why I'm exploring with our leaders every option to redraw our state congressional lines as soon as possible. Our state legislative leaders, Carol Heastie, Majority Leader Andre Stewart Cousins, they're on board, as are their members. We're already working on a legislative process, reviewing our legal strategies, and we'll do everything in our power to stop this brazen assault. As I mentioned, these are profiles in courage sitting with me here today. They left their homes, left their families, left their loved ones in a world of uncertainty. But our history is defined by people who are brave patriots who will not accept the status quo, who believe they must use their voices and their positions to stand up for others. And I could not be prouder to have an opportunity to meet them, each and every one of them, and hear their personal stories. And I thank them so much for making this journey. You are on the right side of history, and you're not alone. Thank you. We are in solidarity with each and every one of you and your colleagues in another state hosted by my great friend, J.B. Pritzker, who welcome you as well. As I said, history will judge us on how we respond to this moment, But here in New York, we will not stand on the sidelines with the timid souls on the sidelines who don't care, will not invest their heart and soul into this battle. This is a war. We are at war. And that's why the gloves are off, and I say, bring it on. With that, let me turn it over to our great speaker, Kyle Hastie.
Listening to live coverage from Albany, Governor Kathy Hochul with Texas Democrats who fled the state.
Thank you, Governor, and thank you to our great colleagues from the great state of
House
Texas.
Speaker Carl Hastie.
You know, I'm a fan of something big in Texas. As, you know, everybody knows I'm one of the bigger Cowboy fans, but today I'm
We're not going to go there. You cannot say that sitting next to me.
I'm a Bills fan as long as they don't play against the Cowboys, but. But we're here for, you know, a serious, you know, moment in time. And, you know, all things are connected. You know, Democrats and some of the editorial boards and some of the very newspapers who are here keep telling us to play fair. And it's very difficult to say play fair when your opponents are playing dirty and using every tool in their tool shed, toolbox, to kind of undermine democracy. Since this guy's been sworn in, there's no respect for the Constitution, there's no respect for people, and this, what's happening in Texas is just another prime example. And what we're proposing that maybe what we bring before the voters in 2027, hope not to have to use it, but sometimes the best way to get a bully to stop being a bully is to remind them that they could also be bullied. So perhaps the Republican members of Congress here in New York could say to their Republican colleagues in Texas, hey, slow down on this because this can also affect us. We'd like the world to play fair. Democracy should be fair. But what we're learning, and again, we're only, you know, God help us, 8 months into this horror movie of this presidency administration is, that big disgusting bill that they're trying to fool people that thinks is good is just nothing more but just another giveaway to the richest of the rich in this country. And so they're trying to fool us by saying, well, we're going to go on with gerrymander and take out Democrats. And you'll hear from, you know, my good colleague, Representative Jones will tell you the members of Congress that are under attack and who they're looking to get rid of. It's just unfair. It's sickening. Like I said, it's really like being in a bad movie of just a hostile takeover of what is supposed to be the greatest country in this world. So sad that we have to be here. But I say to all of you, all of the press here, your editorial boards, keep asking us to be fair and play fair. And I think that's the wrong thing to ask us to do. So with that, I'm going to turn over to my colleague, the leader of the Democrats in the Texas House, Representative Plesa.
Thank you, Governor, and thank you, Mr. Speaker. My name is Mihaela Plesa, and I proudly serve as the vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus and the constituents of House District 70 in Collin County. I just want to thank you for standing with us today and for your leadership. Your continued support reminds us that the fight to protect democracy is not confined to one state. The fight is for all 50, and I'm proud to stand with you. I'm joined here by my colleagues of the Texas House Democratic Caucus, public servants who came to this work not to chase power, but to protect people. I'm proud to stand beside them in this moment of national urgency. But before we get into the redistricting crisis in Texas, I want to acknowledge something else that we share in common that connects us. And that's the recent flooding that happened in both of our states. New York just experienced flooding. They put people over policies and they declared a state of emergency. In Texas, today marks the 1 month anniversary where over 130 people died, the majority of them being children. An incident that our governor has still failed to attend any funerals for the victims. People are rebuilding their lives. Their homes have been destroyed. They're burying their children. Some of them only have the snuffies that their children were clinging on to for support. Did you guys know that there's a nonprofit that's been started in our state that's trying to help parents find those stuffed animals because it's the last thing their children had? Today on the House floor, House Republicans did not want to put flood relief, disaster relief. They didn't want to do anything for the people of Texas. They're bending the knee to President Donald Trump. The first bill put on the calendar today was a redistricting bill, an attempt to steal power. This cannot be allowed to stand. The playing field has changed, not just for Democrats, but all Americans. And it's time to meet them on the new field. Governor Abbott formed a select committee on redistricting. That committee held 9 meetings. We also had a committee on flood relief. That committee only held 2 meetings. That shows you what our governor is focused on, what House Republicans are focused on. It's not the people of Texas. It's the people in power and how to keep that power. I remember when Trump called Georgia. He called the Secretary of State. He told them, I need to just find 11,780 votes. What did Georgia say? No. Well, Donald Trump called our governor. And he said, I just need a small change. I just need you to send me 5 congressional members. And what did our governor say? Sure. Give me a minute. Coming right up. We were sent to the Capitol to serve the people, not political parties. While Texas are waiting for relief, Republican leaders are redrawing maps to silence voters, hijack our democracy. And this doesn't stop with Texas. If Trump and Abbott secede, it will, yeah, give them 5 seats. But then, where else do they go? Ohio? Missouri? Any other Republican legislature with Democratic congresspeople? They're on the chopping block too. Is that fair? Is that just? The fight isn't just about lines on a map. It's about lives on the line. That's why we're here. That's why we're fighting. It's about democracy. It affects every single American. We need Democrats across the country in state houses, in congresses, in communities to say loud and clear, this is not who we are. And this is not what we will accept. This is a rallying cry. This isn't just about the people who voted for us. It's about every American who believes that the power belongs to the people, not one man, not a king. And I will not allow this one man to rewrite the rules of our democracy behind closed doors. This is about representation, about fairness, and about the integrity of our elections. We are not here to resist. We are here to fight. And we are asking for your help in this fight. Thank you so much, Governor.
That is live coverage from Albany. Texas Democrats who fled the state over GOP efforts to redraw congressional maps. Speaking with the governor and the House Speaker, Carl Hastie, Governor Hochul, live there in Albany. We're going to take a quick break and come back with our regularly scheduled segment. It's Monday, and James B. Huntington is here with Local Economic Perspective. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
Hey, this is Matt Hurtado. Join me for Virtual Soundscapes, your gateway to the best music and gaming. Classic tracks from the 8-bit era, modern releases, and interviews with the minds behind the games. Thursday night at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday, so it's time for James B. Huntington and Local Economic Perspective. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, lots going on with this Friday jobs report. Tell folks who may not have heard about this what revisions were made downward in this Friday's jobs report. What does that mean? And then what did the president do in response to those numbers being revised?
The jobs report came out and it was noteworthy, not in good ways, but it turned out that the jobs report itself was number three on the importance list of things connected to it, or the data on the jobs report was running third in importance. First, the report itself, okay. For once, we did not make an estimate for the number of net new non-farm payroll jobs. It was supposed to be 115,000, but it turned out to be 73,000. But still nothing terrible. It's more than population growth requires, but it's certainly not as good as the things we've been seeing. So adjusted and unadjusted employment each got worse, went up 0.1% to 4.2 and 0.2% to 4.6%. Seasonally adjusted jobless was up 200,000 to 7.2 million with 200,000 more of people who have been out for 27 weeks or longer. The two statistics which really show how many Americans are working without any distortion or filters or anything, the labor force participation rate and the employment population ratio, each of those dropped this time to 62.2% and 59.6%. That's 0.1% apiece. People working part-time for economic reasons or keeping shorter hours positions while looking unsuccessfully for longer hours one jumped 200,000 for the second straight month. There are now 4.7 million of those, and they don't count as unemployed. Average private non-farm payroll hourly wages were up 12 cents, a little more than inflation, and are now at 36.44. The American job shortage number, or AJSN, showing latent demand for jobs if there were unadvertised ones suddenly and how quickly they would be filled, up 300,000 to 17.8 million. So what was this month like? Well, it was poor, obviously. I'm not as concerned about the 773,000 jobs as I am that unemployment and participation rates fell too much. Really, between mid-June and mid-July, there's not much seasonal difference, so these things shouldn't be going down unless there is an actual problem. And yes, the tariffs do get part of the blame for this. We have 100,000 fewer rejoining the labor force, which is a good thing, but it was a poor month, and if the effect from the tariffs increases, we may well see quite a similar month in August.
Well, it's not unusual for jobs reports to be revised. That's part of the process here, but this was like a big revision and caused some controversy in terms of how the president dealt with it.
Well, this time, the number of jobs I was quoting, net new non-farm payroll positions, the previous 2 months were reported originally as over 140,000 apiece. Good, quite healthy, but they were slashed way down, and they're now under 20,000 for each of the past 2 months. It's not unheard of, but it's what some people have been suspecting, that the job market is really not quite as strong as we thought. So, yep. As something happened, our president said that the weak jobs numbers were rigged, which is completely unsubstantiated and doesn't seem to mean anything. So he fired the person who is the commissioner, was the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. She was confirmed on a bipartisan basis last year, but he did that. It came around to getting a lot of negative press from experts and people involved, people close to the situation. We had comments ranging from unfortunate to a terrible precedent to various things, saying the likes of that people might resign in the future, and if you want people to stop trusting the numbers, then firing the person confirmed by the Senate is a very good way of doing it. It's a disturbing thing. I don't like it because I've been reporting in various fashions on this data for over 10 years. I've never had any feeling that anything has been deliberately distorted. So we may see that soon. The really strange thing is, the odd thing is that a bad jobs report should have been exactly what Trump wanted. It makes it more justifiable to cut interest rates, which he's been hawking on and harassing the Fed chair about and so on. Now there's a good reason for it. I think a quarter to a half point when they meet in September next would be quite justified if it turns out to be much the same, if the next jobs report, which will come out before, I believe, the Fed meeting should come out after the next jobs report. So if it's continuous, more of same, then we will finally have the first good case we've had in 6 months to lower interest rates.
Well, and the Fed last week resisted that pressure from the White House to leave the policy rate unchanged. But as you're previewing here, they could potentially do something about it in the fall. But what did that window of opportunity, the Federal Reserve's interest rate decision last week, leave open for many Americans?
Well, since they left it the same, and especially now, even more than before this piece came out, it's looking like interest rates will come down a small amount, nothing like the drug-induced seeming 3% that a certain person has been requesting, but something of some significance. So what people are missing out on now has been high savings account rates. We have a lot of people with low rates. So if people can find a way now of locking into higher rates, possibly CDs, if they can manage that, if they can justify that, then it would be a good move, because probably savings rates, they consistently go up or down with the Fed's decision. So that's something to think about. If you have maybe a bit too much money, I mean, it's so easy to not realize that your savings situation has changed. So have a peek at what you have in savings if you have money there, and think about moving some to a higher account and doing it really within the next few weeks. There could be some good money in that for you.
James B., that live coverage from Albany with Governor Hochul and those Texas Democrats have kind of shrunk our time a bit, so I want to make sure we get to the numbers. What were the stock, oil, precious metal, and crypto prices this morning, and how did they change?
Okay, this is a two-week window. This is what they were at early this morning and how much they have changed since 2 weeks before. Gold, $33.58, down $6 on top of last month's break-even, still staying very steady. Silver, $37.31, down $1.07 for a ratio of 90-1 now. Probably a natural correction because it zoomed up really higher than it seemed like it needed to. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 43,589, down 753 over the 2 weeks between the tariffs and the jobs report and concern about future bad data suppression. NASDAQ, 20,650, down 246. That's milder, but still going in the wrong direction. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 66.53, down 48 cents. Good for consumers. The tariffs may well push it down further because they'll be hurting business, which consumes a lot of oil, and it's a worldwide thing, so it's not only the U.S., but it's countries doing business with the U.S. Bitcoin, 114,545, down 4,300 and some. still going back from its 122,000 and some peak 3 weeks ago. British pound 1.3269, up 1.75 cents. The dollar is getting stronger somehow. The same thing affected the euro, 1.1552, down 85 hundredths of a cent. Japanese 100 yen stayed right where it's been, 68 cents. So overall, we have a lot of possibilities this week. Depends on how many tariffs will be announced, how many will be rolled back, and some other factors. It could be a good week. It could be a very good week for the stock market, but once again, we never know what we're going to hear from our capital.
Right. And you're keeping an eye on it. Thank you so much, James B. Local Economic Perspective. James B. Huntington joins us every Monday, local author and economist. James B., appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners. Use your mind.
Quick break, and when we come back, a single bite providing more meals to those in need. We'll find out what's driving that and also about a upcoming fundraiser with the Chandelier Music Festival. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, former Secretary of State Antony Blinken is not a flamethrower.
Maybe I'm not made for these times.
But he certainly has strong opinions on Israel, Gaza, China, Iran, Russia, Biden and Trump, and the rest of the world.
Left unattended, a problem halfway around the world easily comes and bites us.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Our friend Audrey Garrow is here, the executive director of A Single Bite. They are providing to families in need meals, addressing food insecurity in the county, and facing some challenges. I want to talk about that and an upcoming fundraiser to help support you guys. Hi, Audrey. Good morning.
Good morning.
Talk about the number of meals that you guys are providing a week. I went to the mailbox. I got a card from you guys. Surprised to see that nearly 1,000 meals a week. What's driving that increase in demand?
It's very difficult for families to ask for help for anything, but the cost of food, loss of a job, loss of hours, changing in a housing situation. Interestingly, some people end up in facilities, in housing where they don't have the facilities to cook. And we're really proud to be able to, if you have a kid, if you have a child in your household and you need food, you know, A Single Bite is there to provide that. And we're very grateful to the community and to collaborators for making that happen. Because as you know, without community, not-for-profits, really, it would be impossible. So we're really kind of looking forward to this summer and going into the fall, some of the partnerships that we've had for many years and some new ones. We are working actually with Chandelier Music Festival the end of this week on Saturday the 9th. If you have tickets, come to the dinner before. We're having a farm-to-table dinner. Music is food for the soul, and so is local food.
I want to ask you a little bit more about that partnership and that fundraiser. I also just wanted to pick up on something you said about how things are changing, like in terms of housing driving some of this need. Are you seeing different kinds of need since when you first started this? And are you seeing different types of people, like working families, senior citizens, newly food insecure households?
Yes. So food insecurity, defined as lack of sufficient healthy food, really has been linked to poverty. And there has been generational poverty in Sullivan County for generations. What we're seeing now, though, is the cost of living being so out of reach for a lot of people to be able to just take care of their basic needs, housing included. So not only with the cost of rent or a mortgage, which, you know, if you're fortunate enough to own your own home, but actually utilities and some of the other costs that come along with keeping a home going, keeping a house that is functional going, repairing your stove, having a working refrigerator. These things all affect people's ability to be able to eat healthfully.
And what are the biggest challenges you guys are facing right now in terms of keeping up with this meal production and distribution?
Fortunately, we do receive, especially this time of year, wonderful donations of food. local farmers are always happy to share with us their surplus. After the farmers market in Calicoon, every week we receive donations from the farmers who otherwise would, I think, feed animals with their product, which is very important for the food cycle. But we utilize as much as we can this time of year. But the cost of protein, which we try to provide to families because it is rather expensive in the store.
Are rising food costs affecting you then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We try to be mindful of what is most costly to families and to provide that as a priority. And so the meals that we provide, which are containers delivered to folks' homes by our volunteers, we have an army of volunteers. They're amazing. We could cook all day, but if the food doesn't get to people where they need it. And as we learned during COVID, transportation is a huge issue in rural communities. Mm-hmm. And it does affect people's ability to be able to access food and also to be able to, in the case of families that are working multiple jobs, to just get it on the table sometimes.
And let's talk more about that fundraising event coming up, the Chandelier Music Festival. It's the opening night of the festival.
It is.
So how did this partnership come together? And tell us more about how folks can get more information about that.
Well, as I said earlier, not-for-profits like ours don't exist in a vacuum. We can't do it alone. And collaborations like this one with Chandelier Music Festival really came from contributors and supporters who contribute both organizations. And they seem unrelated. But the fact of the matter is that people who care about community, like those folks that support WJFF too, mm-hmm. they're not just supporting one not-for-profit. And so this idea came, well, why can't we do both? And so to be able to provide a beautiful meal cooked by our chef, Chef Jonathan, who cooks for families all week, but is a restaurant chef in his heart, is really an honor to be able to do this before the opening night. This piano performance by Sarah Davis Buckner is something that a lot of folks have been looking forward to. So to be able to kind of combine that with the other kind of food for the soul, which is the nourishment that comes from local food. We're working with local farmers who have donated food, vegetables, and Snow Dance Chicken is giving us some of their beautiful product to put on the table. And also, Terra Bread over in Jeffersonville, he's baking for us. Thank you, AJ. So we're really grateful for that. We're working with many, many businesses in the community to try to raise awareness for what we're doing. Those 900 people a week that we're feeding, they rely on us. And that consistency and the ability to be able to do that, and then in the fall to be able to do the nutrition education that we do, that is all donor supported. We have very, very little government support. We're fortunate at this point to be able to rely on the community, but more and more, yes, we're doing outreach just like every other not-for-profit, and we're very, very grateful for the partnerships that we enjoy.
I want to ask you about the fall. You mentioned the bounty of the summer with farmers and farmers markets being so generous, but as that cycle decreases as you get into fall and winter, then what happens? What challenges are there there for
you? I'm very concerned about food costs. We've had a conversation with Chef about utilizing as much as we can that is donated going forward. We do partner with the Regional Food Bank and with some businesses that consistently have a little bit of surplus products just because of the nature of their business. But we'll go back to purchasing. And that feels a little intimidating at this point. We budget and we do the best that we can, like a family does. We will not skimp. We will provide protein, healthy carbs, and as much vegetable as we can through every meal. 52 weeks a year, we're really proud to be able to do that for families.
What do you need most from folks who might be listening that want to possibly help?
Thank you for asking. Supporting a single bite with a monetary donation is wonderful. You can check us out at asinglebite.org. We have a newly refreshed website. It's beautifully done. And as I said, we could cook all day, but if volunteers don't deliver the food for us, volunteering is the value of those hours and that commitment cannot be overstated.
Audrey Garrow is the executive director of A Single Bite. Their Chandelier Music Festival fundraising dinner is this Saturday at 6. It's the opening night of the music festival as well. A solo piano performance by Sarah Davis Buckner. There's ticket information at asinglebite.org and how you can get involved and work with somebody who's so lovely and nice and just thankful and grateful to have you doing this for all the folks in our community, Audrey Garrow. We'll take a break, and when we come back, another lovely person, Noah Kalina, is up here next. WJFF Radio Catskill. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Jessie King. On this week's 51%, we speak with journalist Katie Simon about the road to healing after sexual assault and how that road can look different for each person.
I really just emphasize all these things are kind of individual and be patient with yourself. Like, you can move through it. It's just, you know, it takes time.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, it's Catherine Marr, CEO of NPR. Federal funding for public media has been eliminated. That means that the NPR network is moving forward in an uncharted future. But our commitment to you will never waver. Please give today to support the kind of journalism that democracy relies upon. Here's how to make your gift to this station, and thank you.
Make your donation at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, recently we partnered with artist and photographer Noah Kalina to learn more about a camel on top of the Berryville Oasis in Berryville, New York. Noah was our special and is our special correspondent on this story. Let's take a little bit of a listen to this hard-hitting journalism.
Driving through Berryville, New York, near the Pennsylvania border, you'll notice something unusual about the local gas station. Right there on the roof of what's called the Berryville Oasis is one of America's newest and greatest roadside attractions. A camel. A camel in New York certainly doesn't belong. Camels are desert animals built to thrive in environments with very little water. But there's plenty of water here. The mighty Delaware River is just down the road.
I'm literally right down the road.
I love this camel. As someone who's made it a point to go off the beaten path in search of unique roadside attractions, the Berryville camel really speaks to me. Perched on the roof of a former service station, standing like a golden sentinel, this fiberglass sculpture commands attention. The camel's lustrous, honey-colored patina catches and reflects the dappled sunlight. The verdant canopy behind it creates an almost ethereal glow that seems to animate the figure. The camel appears frozen in a moment of calm watchfulness. Its elongated neck gracefully arched, head pointed forward, eyes bright and alert, as if surveying the happenings of downtown Berryville. What makes this sculpture particularly compelling to me is its contextual audacity. Here, in the lush, water-rich landscape of upstate New York, this desert dweller becomes a powerful symbol of adaptation and resilience.
And special correspondent, artist and photographer Noah Kalina joins us now. Hello. I think you coined the phrase of the summer, contextual audacity. Yeah, we need the t-shirt.
That was good radio.
Right?
It did, definitely true, I would say.
Yeah. And this, there's much more to this. This is in your newsletter on Substack at noahkalina.com. Also on your YouTube.
That's right.
You can find it on your socials, our socials. As this got published last week, we heard some folks really responding in a very positive way. Very happy to see this. What did you hear?
Yeah, I heard much of the same. I think people were sort of thrilled to hear about the camel that I think a lot of people have been interested in for quite some time. I think, unfortunately, the version I put on Instagram was cut down, so we lost a little bit of the context for the masses, like just in terms of where the camel came from and all of that stuff. But, you know, I can tell you a little bit about that
now.
Tell
us more, yeah.
Roswell, who is one of the owners of the building, said he just loves camels, and, you know, he thought the oasis was an oasis for the town, thought a camel would be appropriate for the roof there, and then he ended up finding a camel out on Long Island. So that's where it came from.
As one does. Well, which I found, I was playing from the video here from your newsletter, And you are a great photographer, by the way. Thank you very much. This is beautifully shot. And also just you drive by and you might notice it and you're like, but why is that there? So you really did go off the beaten path and get the information, the untold story.
That's what I'm trying to do as the special correspondent here at Radio Catskill. I mean, that's what I'm interested in most, is like finding out about the things that we might see on a regular basis and wonder, like, what's the deal? What's the deal with that?
There's a great video here, too. I'm happy to see the video of Roswell transporting the camel in the back of his truck, and they got stopped on the way out of Long Island to upstate.
Yeah, but that's the story he tells, right? Where apparently, you can't drive down the highway on Long Island with a camel in the trunk of your truck. I guess dangerous, and also maybe like a hazard potentially.
Just for other motorists who may be considering such a move, just beware. What was your favorite part of putting this all together? This whole story.
Well, again, it's in the longer cut where I got to go into the restaurant that's under the camel, and the restaurant's called Berryville Oasis, and it's actually really incredible food. I think like, you'd be shocked to know that you could get such a good meal at what looks like a service station, essentially. But, you know, I spent the entire budget on going out to dinner at the Berryville Oasis over a couple of weeks.
Do we get to see some more special correspondent work from you soon?
Yeah, so I'm working on a new story right now about what's called a space and time memorial, and it's on Route 17B and 115, I think, is the intersection there. It's right near Bethel Woods, and there is sort of a park. It's, you know, it's a public park. You can find it on Google Maps if you look for a space and time memorial, and it's just this mystery spot that I've always wondered what it was. And
is that what the flagpole is?
That's right. There's a flagpole. There's a little parking lot, a flagpole, and then symbols on this sort of sculpture that's there. There's an infinity symbol. There's a peace symbol. And then there's a man and woman symbol. And then there's also a compass or a sundial right there. So it's an installation. And I'd always wondered what this was. And I've done it. I've tracked down the guy who owns the property. I've interviewed him. And we've got a story coming up soon.
This is good stuff. Where can folks get your information? Did I say the website right?
Yeah, noahkalina.com. You can find all my links there, but I'm at Noah Kalina at all of your favorite social media platforms.
Noah Kalina, artist and photographer. Thank you also for the great lighting in the studio for my little cameo. I appreciate that more than you know. Thank you so much. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Abir Barakat lives in Gaza City. She and her family are down to one meal a day, if that. And all that's available is bread, pasta, or lentils.
My family is starved. Everybody around us, we are like walking dead. We are like zombies. If you look at us walking in the streets, we feel like drunk people.
Hunger and famine in Gaza. That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There's an air quality alert in effect until midnight tonight due to some wildfires in the Canadian Peninsula, the Canadian Rocky area, where there are some fires burning there. When these pollution levels are elevated, the New York State Department of Health recommends that individuals consider limiting strenuous outdoor physical activity to reduce the risk of adverse health effects. People who may be especially sensitive to the effects of elevated levels of these pollutants include very young, those with pre-existing respiratory problems such as asthma or heart disease, and those with symptoms should consider consulting their personal physician. Again, that active air quality alert in effect till midnight tonight for our region. Otherwise, it'll be sunny, some clouds moving in this afternoon, high 82, partly cloudy tonight, low 59. Some of those areas of smoke could reduce visibility at times. Overcast and hazy with a high near 80 tomorrow. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.